Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This program was brought to you by Eat On North. Eat On North is a casual restaurant where honest, uncomplicated food is served without pretension. Find Eat On North at hotelonnorth.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In The Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And I'm sure that most of you are familiar with the author, at least her name, Zora Neale Hurston. What a great name. How could you not be familiar with her with that name, right? But her wonderful books, wonderful writings. But what you probably don't know is we owe a lot to her for culinary history. And here to talk about it is the author of a new book. The new book is Zora Neale Hurston on Florida Food. And my guest is Frederick Douglass Opie. Fred is a professor of history and foodways at Babson College and has received his BS and PhD from Syracuse University. Dr. Opie writes and speaks frequently about his research and the African influences of American food, especially Southern foodways. And you can read about it on his blog, Food as a Lens. He's a frequent contributor on the radio show, Splendid Table. And his other books include Hog and Hominy, Soul Food from Africa to America, Black Labor Migration in Caribbean Guatemala, and Upsetting the Apple Cart, Black and Latino Coalitions in New York, From Protest to Public Office. Fred, it's a pleasure to welcome you to my show today.
Oh, Linda, thank you. The pleasure's all mine.
You did this book on Zora Neale Hurston, and now what a lot of people don't know, and for me it's kind of a continuation of one of my other shows, which was all about the America Eats program and the project of employing or putting to work unemployed writers and sending them out in the field to try to capture regional cuisines and let the country know what people were really eating. Zora Neale Hurston is probably one of the best-known writers that the WPA put out there for that project. And she did something much more than just capture regional cuisines. She actually was instrumental in capturing a lot of the African diaspora of foodways, of foods, in the Southern Sea, particularly Florida. What drew you to research Zora and write about this?
Well, there's a course that I teach and have been teaching for a while called African American History and Foodways. And one of the texts in the course is Their Eyes Were Watching God, which is her probably most well-known publication. And as I was reading the book, it was on the heels of finishing and publishing my first book, Hog and Hominy. And one of the things I noticed is food was just everywhere within that novel. And my eyes just began to be trained after the publication of my first food history to see food just about everywhere. But you didn't have to work very hard to do that when you looked at Their Eyes Were Watching God. So my mind was, if it's that much in here, where else is it in her many publications? And she is quite prolific in a number of genres, including short story, plays. There's a lot of different things that people don't necessarily know because I only know that one book.
Right. Well, it was quite a book. I mean, and it did capture so much in that. And you're right. Food was everywhere. Not unlike a lot of other writers. And a little spoiler, you actually presented to the Culinary Historians of New York last night. And you said something very interesting and so well on point and profound in a way that people write about food. Usually they learn to cook excellent dishes and write about food and talk about food when they don't have food.
Mm-hmm. Right? And that certainly is the case in Zora. When you, the more you learn about her life, the more you begin to understand why food was not something that she set out to do. It just happened organically because it was constantly an issue with her own life.
Mm. Tell me a little bit about that life and why she was the right match for capturing the whole Florida food scene.
Well, Zora was born in 1891 in Alabama, and her family moved shortly thereafter to Florida, to Eatonville, Florida, which is an all-black township. So she
That's very important that a lot of people don't realize. And yeah. It was one of the all-black townships that existed.
She grew up in an enclave where segregation, Jim Crow, did not have a direct influence on her life until she left that township, which is a very unusual situation. So when you look at Zora, you get a chance to learn about African Americans who are very self-sufficient. Most of what they consume. They produce most of what they consume. So when you looked at her her memoir, where she talks about growing up in Eatonville, from the date of birth, as I mentioned last night during the talk, she was born during the hog killing season. So that's a time where it was a very collective experience of whites and blacks getting together. But mostly in her case, there were only a few whites that lived outside of Eatonville, but they would also come and participate. So she's born around food. She's talking about food. And food is not a hardship for her growing up because she's a preacher's kid. Her father, as a lot of ministers in the South at the time, had his own church in Eatonville, but he also was an itinerant minister where he had several congregations that he would travel to on a monthly circuit. So he was doing very well financially, and she didn't suffer for anything. It's after that time period, later on in her life as a teenager, that when the hardship really begins.
Right. It's interesting, as you mentioned, that she was born during the hog killing season, and she actually wrote about that and captured that and the festivities surrounding it. And you also capture it in your book about her. This was no small event. People say, oh, they're hog killing, they're killing hogs. No, they waited and waited for this. And tell us a little bit about some of the activities that would surround that that event.
So you can imagine several families, let's say a dozen families would get together, and all of them that raised hogs would collectively come together, corral the hogs to one area. So I have images in the book of anywhere between six and a dozen or more hogs slaughtered at the same time. So this is labor-intensive, to say the least. So the people would all get together. The men would process the hogs. They would slaughter them. And as they begin to butcher the hogs, the different parts of the carcass would be given to the women who would begin to prepare a meal. So it's a collective activity. We will give our blood, sweat towards this. And in exchange, the women of the group are going to make food and feed everybody. So we're going to have things like crackling, which is taking the skin of the hog after all the hair has been burned off. The skin is just going to be put in deep fried pots, and pots made from the lard of the hog. So everything, nothing's wasted at all.
Nose to tail.
Nose to tail. You have hog head cheese is going to be processed, which is you take every part of the hog and you're going to chop it up and mold it into a cheese. So the process of slaughtering the hog, making hams, storing those hams, salting them, storing them in a smokehouse, all that's going to go on. And you're talking about from probably dawn to dusk, this process is going on. But while you're doing it, people are going to be singing, people are going to be laughing, and people are going to be eating.
Eating, absolutely, right. I mean, these were huge festivities, and not only in those communities, but in rural farm townships all around. I mean, people would get together and do it, and that was so interesting that event or activity was captured. That was something that WPA. That they gave that tip to a lot of the writers to try to get invited to these church socials, church dinners, to these festivities and special events, because somehow they were prescient and knew that these group activities were going to be important to record and to capture. And Zora did a terrific job, and it's included in several of her stories, and then afterwards by other writers who discovered her. Mm-hmm. And that is something about the juke joint. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So one of the things that you see in Zora's work as a WPA writer, but even before that, when she first leaves Barnard College here in New York and she goes out to do field work, she decides that she's going to track the history, the culture, and the folklore of working class people, of the underemployed. So she's looking at turpentine workers and turpentine camps. These are not people who are leaving home every day, going to a job, and come back. No, they are isolated. They are working out in turpentine camps, and they're harvesting turpentine from pine trees, harvesting that process, and they're staying in a camp-like scenario situation, barracks, liking it to being on a plantation scenario. She's also looking at sawmill workers, same thing. These people are not coming back and forth from their home. They're going out to these places where they're harvesting the wood, living in a camp-like situation, and there's a commissary that the owner of this particular industry is who owns. So it's very much a debt peonage situation where you sign on and you end up spending more money on paying back your boss for the supplies that you need, from clothing to health care to food. And then she's also looking at people in the agricultural world. Each and every one of these settings I'm talking about, as I mentioned, are isolated. And it's a situation where you're working from Monday to Saturday, one day off, which is Sunday, or a special occasion holiday. And leisure for these people very often is a juke joint. And it's a you see a facility that's run by one of the workers who at one time or another earned enough money to put together a shack, and that's probably generous to say a shack, where a person who is an entertainer will go from one of these camps to the other performing. And in exchange for performing, they're going to get some wages. So they're going to have live music. It's going to be very elementary. And not until you have the invention of radios, Victrolas and things like that. But you're talking about live music, usually guitar, banjo, very simple stuff. Think about people like Bloody, I'm just trying to think of the guy from Mississippi.
Muddy Waters,
people like that. Just a number of people. You're going to have food, because food is going to be a way that the person who runs that juke joint is going to make money. So his revenue comes from the artist, the food, and the dancing that goes on. So that's the juke joint. And it's
somebody, I'm sure, passed a bottle around.
And liquor.
Some moonshine, right?
And so you got food, liquor, and entertainment. And the food and the entertainment are intricately involved, but so is the moonshine. And it's not your general. Now, some places may have beer, but most times it's going to be moonshine made from anywhere, because you need to be able to produce a cheap form of non-taxed alcohol that you can make a lot of money off. So right. that's your juke joint scenario.
Right. Interesting. And you mentioned at the juke joints, I mean, you can just, you know, get pictures and see, you know, from past films and great books that, you know, really gave the descriptions. You can hear it, you can feel it, you know, and especially in the hot South. But you talked earlier about these work camps, whether they be, you know, for whatever industry, corn, turpentine, sawmills, apples up north. I mean, and then the owner owning the store. I mean, this was so much part of not even Depression era, but even earlier. And, you know, and then the owner of these camps owned the company store. That song keeps going through my mind. I owe my soul to the company store. I mean, they pay them some wages, and then they have to spend the wages at the company store to buy back what they need. And it was a meager living, but, you know, it kept them alive during that era.
What's interesting is, you know, after slavery is abolished in the South, in 1865, the predicament of the South, the problem of the South, first of all, is rebuilding the South. Right. Places like Georgia, where the war just absolutely destroyed the infrastructure. But the other large problem is labor. One of the definitions of being free was the ability to move and go where you wanted. So many of the majority, I would say, of enslaved people, when they became free people, they left. So how do you coercively maintain a labor force for yourself? Well, you created a number of systems of debt peonage. You created a penal system where you arrested African-Americans and poor whites. So let's just be really clear on this. African-Americans and poor whites with all kinds of trumped up charges, that you would get a ridiculous fine of, you know, 4 or 5 months in jail for walking the wrong side of the street, for one of the laws is a labor law where it was required that you had a job. And if you didn't have one and you couldn't provide papers to show you work for, you were arrested. So these were quite common laws throughout the South after 1865. And many of these laws existed all the way to the time of World War II. It was not until the Cold War when the Russians would put pressure on the United States and other parts of the communist world, would look at the United States and see, oh, you're free and you're a democracy. Look at how you treat your laborers in the South. That's when these things begin to be challenged and changed.
Right. Interesting stories, and we're going to hear a lot more about those stories and more of the food within those stories when we come back after a short break.
Still at school, all the good times that we shared.
Hi, I'm Brian Allberg, and I'm the executive chef at Eat On North in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts. Eat On North in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts is a casual restaurant where good, honest, uncomplicated food is served to our guests. Our restaurant is part of a hotel called Hotel On North, the newly opened boutique hotel in downtown Pittsfield. We source local ingredients from our neighboring farms and offer an all-day dining menu of flavorful American cuisine for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and on weekends we serve brunch. Our oyster bar serves up delicious shellfish and oyster samplers until 11 p.m. Check out our menu at eatonnorth.com and follow us on Instagram.
Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Fred Opie, the author of Zora Neale Hurston on Florida Food. And Zora was not only just a WPA writer, as you mentioned, too. I mean, the WPA hired all these out-of-work unemployed writers at that time because it was the Depression, but she had written so much before that. I mean, she was an established writer. You know, she just wasn't at that time. All these writers, even Saul Bellow and a few other writers. I mean, there were some well-known names that went on not just to do work for the WPA about food for America Eats, but in a lot of they sent them out in the field to do all kinds of writing and work, which was terrific. It kept them being able to practice their craft. Zora did it with aplomb, I must say. she captured so much. And unfortunately, well, you can tell us a little bit. She was sort of lost there for a while until she was rediscovered in the 20th century, basically, right?
Yes, so after she's publishes her book, The Eyes Are Watching God, and I don't have the publication dates in front of me, so she has a number of things that are that do extremely well as far as
I think it was 26. It might have been 26 or 29. I'm not particularly sure.
But what people need to remember is after the Harlem Renaissance, which is by the time of the Great Depression, the Harlem Renaissance has shut doors for African Americans in the publishing field. So that it's not that African Americans stopped writing after the end of the Harlem Renaissance, but when you don't have a place to publish, I mean, that's a challenge. And so what you see is she and a lot of the other noted people from the Harlem Renaissance period, they are just trying to make a living by any way they can. Some of them becoming deep WPA workers. Some of them traveling and becoming teachers or becoming part of a theater troupe. So she's doing a number of things to try to make things, you know, just work for her. And she does a lot of field work. She continues to do that. But she has to depend on white patrons to do these things, whether it be the white patrons, whether it be from a private sector, or whether it be from the government in the form of the WPA work.
All right. And as this WPA work was so valuable, but when you were doing your research, where did you find a lot of the material about from this?
So the year that I dedicated to this, so I had first done a paper for a conference, a literary conference down in New Orleans, and I put together this paper strictly using Their Eyes Are Watching God, food in Their Eyes Are Watching God. And then after that, I started to map out what I would do, and I applied for a fellowship at Harvard University at the Hutchinson Center run by Henry Louis Gates. And during that fellowship year, I had access to the very immense source of documents through Harvard's library. Harvard has the luxury, and I'm sure some other schools, you know, that have that kind of resource, it can do, that I could go on and I could find every one of her publications, every one of her books, in a electronic version. Oh. So I could download the book, and then I could do word searches throughout the book. And so I found just about everything that she wrote available. Then I did some research at special collection libraries at places like Yale University, and then at the Library of Congress. So between the online resources at Harvard and the archival research at Yale and the Library of Congress, I had pretty much everything that I would need. I thought originally that the largest archival holdings for Zora Neale Hurston's are at University of Florida at Gainesville, their main campus at Flagship University. But I never made it down there. But I had more than enough. And I remember having a conversation early in the game with Henry Louis Gates, and I remember him saying, I don't know if you have enough to do a book. But I certainly found that there were plenty of things. And then I also found that the State Archives of Florida had a very good collection of food-related images. So between those images, the archival stuff, I found a lot. And then to add to it, and that's one of the things you do at research, as a researcher, you know, you have a great idea for a project, but do you have the sources to pull it off? The other thing I came upon at Harvard was the ProQuest Historical Research, historical newspapers. And they had a whole collection of African-American-owned newspapers that you could search. So I could actually go on, search those newspapers, download them as PDFs with doing word searches. So I could isolate words like collard greens, kale, turnips, sweet potatoes, yams, just about anything, rice. And so I could tell the online source for ProQuest that I want you to look for this particular word in from 1880 to 1935. And then it would just pull up all these things. So once you know what you're looking for and you know how to do research, I was able to pull out what I wanted. And it's just a treasure trove. You could pull up just recipes, or you could pull up another thing where I would say to people that you may necessarily think about. So Mark Bittman just stepped down from the New York Times after doing a full food column for a long time. Well, you know, African-American newspapers had people doing columns. And many of us don't even realize who these people were. Mm-hmm. Well, there's just all these things that came out in the process of finding recipes for the Zora book that I learned about this whole genre of black writers working for black newspapers, like the Chicago Tribune or a Chicago Defender, Pittsburgh Courier. It's there's so many of these newspapers that one could go into and decide how you want to write and do food-related research.
It's wonderful. I mean, the online access to these are—it's just you say, well, you know, you devoted a year or two to doing the research. You know how long that would have taken you years ago. I mean, you would still be working on this.
I can tell you, this is I think book number 4, and this was written faster than any other one. Simply what you just said, because I had online sources. It would be—I'd go gallivanting from one archive to another, one state to another, one country to another. With this one, I could sit in my office and pretty much pull up the majority of what I need with a couple of trips doing field work.
Well, now, listeners, beware, because I have people ask me questions often about, you know, how to do research, where do we do research, what sources are good resources for different studies. And I say, listeners, beware, because just don't Google a topic. You just heard Fred say he went to Harvard, he, you know, got access to their libraries, went to Yale. You don't just Google a word. And please don't take whatever you find on Wikipedia for source, okay? You know, you have to do your homework on this, too, first, before you do that. Well, you mentioned, you know, doing isolated word searches on food. And of course, so many of these settlements were African-American workers primarily, and the words rice, collard greens, yams, sweet potatoes come up often. What were the workers' meals primarily? Did you get a sense of a lot of that, and were they cooking foods that they knew and foods of from their past?
So there's two types of answers to this question. One is what are they receiving as rations?
No, true.
And this is really important as we talked about the type of work camps these people were. They were receiving rations from elite people who ran and organized these camps. These camps had overseers just like a plantation, just like a mine or anything else. And so they had rations. The rations usually were beans and rice. Usually beans and rice were always in there. And then salt pork, fat back, bacon, all the same things. And guess what? Remarkably, these are the same rations that you would see during the antebellum period for the end of slavery. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the same type of rations because they're inexpensive, they keep long. You would sometimes see sweet potatoes or yams. Again, another ration given out during the enslavement period because they kept well and they were inexpensive to purchase. So you would see pork, salted pork meat, rice, beans, and then you would often see cornmeal. Those are pretty much the same thing. Now, when they're eating on their own, and that's when you would see them supplement their rations. Again, a strong parallel to what you see during the period of slavery, where slaves went out during the nighttime and would supplement their meal, particularly if they lived near a waterway, they do a lot of fishing on their own. You see the workers in the work camps that Zora visited doing the same thing. They would catch their own fish, and then when they would have time, their leisure time, their Sunday day off or a holiday, that's when they would do a barbecue. And so they would work to get together, pitch their money in, save up their money, and they'd have a barbecue, and somebody would mix up a batch of moonshine.
Yeah. It's interesting because the barbecue is known now throughout other parts of the U.S., they vary dramatically. And a lot of this barbecue probably comes from the West Indian islands that a lot of these people originally came from, and barbecue was really just meat cooked over outdoor fires, and it was delicious. Whatever they put on it afterwards, it was that cooking process, slow cooking process over the fires that was so great. Yeah, and that
absolutely. That's, you know, great. Zora also did work in the Caribbean, and one of the things that you see her talk about during her trip to Jamaica is how much she loved jerk meat. She even went to the process of going with members of a community to hunt their own boar, wild boar, which is extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
I mean, the description of what happens.
Wild
is,
boar. They call them wild for a reason.
You know, there's a member of this hunting party is actually, I mean, hurt, might be the point of long-term injury, but she goes with them. She watches them, you know, catch the wild boar, and she watches them go through the process of butchering the meat, cooking the meat, and she talks about, you know, how much she enjoyed that kind of jerk meat.
Interesting. When you said there'd be the cornmeal and the meat and the and something that we didn't talk about, and that was the molasses. Again, a connection with the islands, and that would be molasses. And you referred to them, or she did, as the three M's. That was her thing.
Typical throughout the South among all ethnic groups that you typically see, the Scots, Irish, the German, African Americans, is that the three M's, that's meat, meal, and molasses. And the meat is always pork. It's always salt pork because it keeps well. So those are the three that you see throughout, and how they're used may differ, but they are the most important staples in the South. Meal, cornmeal, meat, pork meat, and then molasses. And molasses is one of those things that are used for a number of different ways as sweeteners. It's used as remedies and when somebody's sick. So just a number of different ways that you see people eating that.
All right. Didn't want to end our show without talking about remedies, because you are speaking actually tonight at the New York Academy of Medicine, and they're doing a wonderful series on eating through time, and you're one of the lecturers this month, and you're going to be talking about her research on food as remedies. And you can tell us just a little snippet of that.
Sure. You know, I hope those that are listening will come out. The focus on the talk is, one of the goals of the organization is to eliminate health disparities. And one of the things I'll be laying out is, why do health disparities exist, and taking a look at the life and times of Zora Neale Hurston and her field work to look at those causes. And then I look at solutions. There's one thing to talk about a problem, but I'm a person who tends to want to talk about the solutions, about the agency of people who are marginalized. So it's one thing to say that these people were treated terrible at the work camps, that they were in debt peonage. But that's not the end of the story. They also are very much involved in their agency of creating a life for themselves within a very precarious situation. And so I will be talking about that tonight, and the number of herbal remedies or recipes that Zora collected throughout her time and throughout her career as an anthropologist and ethnologist. So that'll be the center of that talk. So if you're into natural medicines from the U.S. South, from the Caribbean, a lot of what I'll be talking about is rooted in African remedies that continued on through a process of oral history. So that'll be, I think, for me, it was a very rich part of the research for the project. It made it into the book, into an entire chapter I call Food Pharmacy.
And I actually had to smile at the end of I was just leafing through, and I'm just trying to capture some recipes and look at recipes, and I'm reading recipes. She's talking about, I don't know what she's making, a whole mess of greens or something, and cooking it, and how everything's, you know, coming up, and it's so wonderful, and you could slap it anywhere on your body, and you're going to feel better. I had to smile because I didn't realize I was in the chapter on natural remedies. I was going to eat the stuff, you know. It sounded good.
Yeah, what's really interesting is the whole idea of grains. And I don't know, one of my children, my daughter loves broccoli. I think it was my daughter. She loves broccoli. And my kids are at the age of 10 and 12 where they're doing a lot of cooking themselves, and I encourage that. So my daughter made some broccoli, and then there was all this liquid at the bottom. And she went to toss it in the sink, and I was like, "What? What are you doing? You know, that's pot liquor. You know, that's what we would call that in the South. There are so many important vitamins and nutrients in that liquor that people often forget. When you are cooking, you don't want to take that stuff and throw it out. And those are the kind of things that you learn from Zora and from her mother throughout, and the cooks that she meets along her field work. So just the importance of taking every aspect of a food and getting the most out of it.
You take that piece of bread or that cornbread and you sop up that pot liquor and don't throw it away. And, you know, it's interesting because I often talk about great cuisines, international cuisines, and they all usually start as cuisines of poverty. And they all know you don't waste a thing, and you take that bread or whatever source you have to sop up whatever liquids, because that's definitely,
you know,
good stuff.
The other aspect that I've found interesting in doing this work over almost 12 years now is when I would go out into the field, a lot of times I thought I was just doing African-American culinary history. And just what you just said, Linda, what I've found is that we're really talking about the culinary history of people from rural communities who, no matter where they are, they're doing what they can to consume and not waste, you know, which is a big thing in the food movement now. A lot of chefs are like, but by the way, if you work in a kitchen and a chef sees you throw something away that could be reused or repurposed, you're going to get fired.
That's right.
Well, that's how these people are the same way. You'll see some of these same techniques.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you so much for sharing all this information. And you can find more of Fred's work on fredopie.com and his blog, foodisalens.com. And I think it's just fascinating how we can use food as a lens to study culture and history. And thank you so much for joining me.
A pleasure. I loved doing it. And I think your show is going to be one of my new favorites on podcasts I download and listen
to.
Well,
we'll send you the link and you can share your podcast. And thank you for listening. And be sure to listen in to all of our broadcasts here on A Taste of the Past at heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. the comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.